Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Excuse me. Your panel for this afternoon is to my right, Justice Bill Meyer. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofano. We have two cases set for oral submission, but there will be a panel change after the first case. Understand both sides are ready. Is that right? All right. So if you'll call the first case, we'll get started.
Your Honor, may it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, this case is basically a business case. It involves a lawsuit that was brought in state court by one partner against another partner with respect to an operating agreement to operate a nail salon. The other defendant in this case facilitated the ability of the nail salon to operate by entering into a lease for the building where the nail salon was, and only was in that capacity as facilitating these partners was that defendant involved. This appeal was filed because a number of errors we believe were made by the trial court. The first error that we claim that was made involves basically the defendant Dip Tuitt Vo. In this case, since this was a suit against Ms. Vo by her partner for breach of an operating agreement, and the party stipulated that they had an operating agreement, so there's no dispute as to the facts regarding the operating agreement, the trial court entered a judgment that included not only the breach of contract and the damages that they had requested in the breach of contract, but also included an award of damages with respect to a tort action. Now, the actual issues that were submitted to the jury never requested any finding from the jury as to whether Ms. Vo actually committed any tort violations. The only liability that the court attached to her was in connection with the claim of the conspiracy, based upon the fact that the jury did find that the tort action, tort claims against Mr. Ba Nguyen were valid, and that found that there was a conspiracy, and that's how she became liable. But to look at this case, if you look at really what this case is about the breach of an operating agreement. The only damages sought in this entire case by the plaintiff in this case were the lost profits, with respect to her portion of the lost profits, the loss of her investment. She asked for lost wages, even though we'll address that later, that there was no evidence as to lost wages. And that's the only damages that were sought. These are purely economic damages. And under the economic loss rule, that would basically mean that this is a contract type case. But regardless of that, this court, in last year in the AZZ Inc. versus Morgan case, basically said that although a party is entitled to sue for alternative damages in tort or in contract, that there has to be theories on a separate and distinct injuries. In this case, the injuries were the same. In fact, the issues that were submitted to the jury with respect to the amount of the damages for lost profits in the contract and the tort action were exactly the same. They used the same number.
But they were only awarded those damages in the judgment once, correct?
That was the plaintiff's attempt to avoid the one recovery rule that this court set forth that are confirmed in the AZZ case that was entered last year. That basically the bottom line is, they asked for the contract damages for breach of for the lost profits and for attorney's fees for breach of contract, which they were entitled to. Under the tort action, they asked for the same damages, and they asked for lost profits, which was still a contract measure of damages, and they asked for loss of investment, which is still a contract measure of damages.
Saying they can't get lost wages and loss of investment for breach of fiduciary duty?
They can if they can prove that. That's true.
That was one of their causes of action, tort causes of action, was breach of fiduciary duty, correct?
Not against the plaintiff. It was against the defendant Vaux. It was against the defendant Wynn.
Right.
Right. They certainly can get the contract, measure of damages against the defendant Wynn for the tort action based upon the jury's findings in the case. But they can't get the same damages against the defendant Vaux, since they had a finding both of contract and of tort. Basically, this court is held, as they did in the AZZ case, that a party is entitled to but one satisfaction for the injury sustained.
But you can get damages for torts if it's separate damages, separate and apart from your contract damages.
Correct, you can, but this is not separate and apart from the contract damages.
That's your argument.
That's my argument. That this is basically the damages that she's asking for, lost profits, lost investment, and lost wages. Those are all the part of the contract. That's damages she suffered as a result of the contract. And the economic loss rule basically says if you're asking for contract damages and you're asking for tort damages, they may both apply, but you have to look at the nature of the damages that are being requested. If the nature of the damages being requested are just contract damages, then it lies in contract and not in tort. Just because the trial court judge didn't duplicate the damages doesn't change the matter of fact that these were contract damages that they were seeking.
How about addressing for me just a moment the $20,000 that was taken out of the operating account? Not, as I understand it, everyone at trial conceded that was not done according to the operating agreement, but was an effort on the part of Ms. Vaux to cover Mr. Gwynn as far as his having signed the lease for them. And that appeared to have been an issue that no one contested at trial from my reading of the record. And if that $20,000 was taken out of the business without being consistent with the operating agreement, isn't that an element of damages that was simply tried by consent and proven by consent?
Well, it would be. But the facts indicated that at a later date that Ms. Vaux was paid an equal amount of $20,000 that was taken out of the business at a later date when Ms. Vaux had already had reopened another business. There's testimony in the case that Ms. Vaux was later given an equal amount of $20,000. So I think that issue became moot based upon.
I missed that in reading the briefs and the record. I didn't see that.
Yeah, she testified that she was received an additional $20,000. It was several months later, after Ms. Vaux had taken the salon back over.
She'd already been kicked out on January 31st.
That's correct. In February, she received $20,000 to compensate for that.
Thank you, sir.
With respect to the lost profits, the argument with respect to the lost profits is that there was no evidence of lost profits. The only testimony, the first thing is that there's no testimony that she was ever an employee. She was a nail tech, and most nail techs, there was some testimony that some nail techs were employees and some nail techs were independent contractors. She never testified whether she was one or the other. Second thing is, the only evidence that she offered in the trial that she had any lost wages was she testified as to the wages that were reflected by the tax returns for the last 3 years that she received in addition to her share of the profits. And The thing is, the measure of damages for lost wages, even if we can assume that there was an employment agreement, is the difference between what you were being paid and what you got paid after the damages occurred. She never testified that she had no ability to go to work as a nail tech somewhere else, or that she didn't in fact go to work as a nail tech somewhere else and maybe made more money. So they never proved the second element of lost wages. One is the wages that you were paid before compared to the wages that you get now. If you don't testify as to the wages you get now, how do you calculate the difference between what you were being paid and what you're being paid now to figure out what the measure of your damages are? You can't just assume that because you were paid X amount of dollars while you were there that afterwards you didn't get paid anything without any evidence to support that. And there's no evidence in the record other than her testimony that for the 3 years she was there, she received X amount of dollars. So there's no evidence to support lost wages whatsoever. With respect to the the issue of the election of remedies, this court has basically said that I understand that election of remedies is a affirmative defense if you as a party to a lawsuit want to make the other party before it goes to final judgment to select a remedy. You can do that, and if you don't plead it, you don't get that opportunity. But if you don't plead it and you don't get that opportunity, you still have to. The court still basically has to make a decision. You can't recover damages from two different causes of action for the same injury. You've got to. The court has got to look at it, and the case law is very clear. AZC and all the other cases, even the cases cited by the respondent in this case, basically say that if there's not an election, then the court has to basically make an election for them that accords them the most amount of damages. Pick one or the other, whichever accords the most amount of damages. If they don't do that and it goes to the Court of Appeals, the cases very clearly say the Court of Appeals is obligated to make that election for them and pick the cause of action that accorded them the most amount of damages. And in this case, it's the same damages, the contract damages that they're asking for either in tort or in contract. So we're basically saying if you add up the damages without the lost wages, which we believe there's no evidence of lost wages, that the contract measure of damages is, and we're really talking about Ms. Vo. We're not talking about Mr. Wynn. The jury clearly found against him on the tort actions. But with respect to Ms. Vo, this court should reform the judgment with respect to the contract being the contract measure of damages on this case and not the tort measure of damages. With respect to lost profits, we believe that there's not enough evidence with respect to lost profits either, because the thing is, with respect to lost profits, they did testify as the profits that they had made beforehand and that they had been reflected on the tax returns. But you've got to show what this business had only been in effect for 3 years. You've got to show something to the effect of what were the profits that it made after you were gone. Now, they had the opportunity through discovery to subpoena their tax returns or bank statements or whatever to get some idea as to what the profits that business made after she was gone. And then you could determine the amount of lost profits. If you're just basically going by what was testified to, all she testified to is what it made before. She gave no opportunity about what was made afterwards. Finally, with respect to the issue of conspiracy, the parties in this case clearly, there was no doubt throughout this case that they were arguing that Mr. Wynn was the agent of Ms. Vo in acting in this case with respect to assisting her to breach this agreement. And the case law clearly says that if an agent is working for a principal, that there cannot be any conspiracy between an agent and a principal. And that's really the case. Mr. Wynn can be liable by virtue of the fact that he had no contractual relationship and the tort liability established by the jury's findings can establish liability against him. But you can't establish liability against her under conspiracy because of the fact that he was just her agent. It was just her. If they wanted to get issues against her, Ms. Vo, for tort liability, they should have submitted issues to the jury asking for the jury to determine whether she breached a fiduciary duty, whether she intentionally interfered.
Wasn't that your burden to prove that he was her agent? So shouldn't you have requested an issue on that?
No, I believe they stipulated that in the case, that he was her agent, that he was Ms. Vo's agent. I don't think they used the term agent, but the phraseology they used in the trial was that he was acting on her behalf. I mean, that was their whole point. I think they, throughout the case, they were trying to argue that he was acting for her, and I think the point of, the reason they wanted to do that was try to establish some liability on her part. I mean, they chose not to ask the trial court to submit jury issues with respect to her being, whether or not he was her agent and whether or not she was personally liable for breach of fiduciary duty or tortious interference. All they asked was that whether Mr. Wynn was. They never asked whether she was, and they could have done that. And so.
So you disagree that's your burden?
Yes. And basic
authority to support that, I'd be interested in hearing it.
Unless it's in the brief, I'm not. I can't remember anything off the top of my head right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here today to argue on behalf of Appley Karen Vu that the trial court's judgment should be affirmed in all respects. And I can tell from your prior discussion with Mr. Frazier that the court is well acquainted with the facts, but I would like to highlight a few things for the court in response to Mr. Frazier's argument. First, Appley and Appellant Vo purchased a nail salon and they operated it under an existing lease until such time they tried to renew the lease and they were unable to do so because of their inability to provide the proper credit. So Appellant Nguyen entered into the lease agreement on behalf of Appellant Vo and Appley. And there was no written agreement between the parties regarding his obligations to act on their behalf to enter into that lease agreement. But there is plenty of testimony on the record that says that Appellant Nguyen had no authority to act on behalf of the business or to do anything with respect to the day-to-day activities. And the terminology that the parties used was stand-in, that Mr. Nguyen acted as a stand-in on behalf of the lease only. So with respect to the civil conspiracy claims, the appellants have failed to establish that he acted as an agent for anything more than the stand-in on the lease on both of their parties' behalves. One overreaching issue that the appellants have in this case is the fact that they've waived their complaints on appeal. And as the court is well aware, election of remedies is an affirmative defense that must be raised before judgment. The doctrine of election of remedies is affirmative defense according to Medina versus Herrera, which is 927 Southwest 2nd, 597 600. That's a Texas Supreme Court case from 1996. And several courts have held that if the defense of election remedies is relied on to defeat recovery, it must be specifically pleaded. I would refer the court to Sanderson versus Smith, which is 2010 Westlaw 2784302. That's a Tyler case, and while it's not published, it is a petition denied case. In addition, Compass Bank versus MFP Financial Services, which is found at 152 Southwest 3rd, 844, stands for that same proposition. And this court has held that an affirmative defense cannot be raised for the first time on appeal. And I would refer the court to Watson versus Tipton, which is 274 Southwest 3rd, 791. Appellant's counsel spent a lot of time today talking about the fact that this is a contort and that the economic loss rule would bar recovery. That was not mentioned in the brief of the appellant, and I would submit to the court that that issue has not been properly raised before the court today. And it's a longstanding proposition of Texas law that there's a party's actions can result in a tort violation and a breach of contract action as well. Appellant's issues 1 and 2 deal with the election of remedies doctrine, and because that's waived, we'd ask the court to sustain the jury verdict with respect to the award of damages on the breach of contract and the tort claims. The remainder of appellant's issues revolve around a perceived error in the jury charge. Again, the issue here is that the appellants have failed to object to the submission of the charge before it went to the jury. I would refer the court to the charge conference that's contained in volume 4, page 92 of the record, where the appellants did not assert a single objection to the charge. With respect to lost wages, even if you look at the merits of these claims, there's sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding. The court's very familiar with the legal and factual sufficiency standards of reviews. Here, there's more than a scintilla of evidence to support the jury's findings regarding lost wages.
Did she testify to what she made after she was no longer working at this nail salon?
No, she did not. You will not find that in the record. However, she was never asked whether or not she attempted to try to work after she was forcibly denied entry into the premises. And it's the violation of those torts that caused her to sustain the lost wages damages.
His position is it was your burden to prove what she was making up to that point minus what she made after that point to come up with truly lost wages.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my understanding of his argument. Again, the issue of lost wages was submitted to the jury, and I believe that they should have objected to that submission on the failure to provide evidence before the submission went to the jury.
Sufficiency of the evidence even on appeal without that objection.
That's true.
So what's the evidence to support the award that the jury gave?
The evidence that supports the award that the jury gave is her testimony of what she made as a nail technician during the years 2010, 11, and 12. And I believe that the evidence under a factual sufficiency of the evidence review will show that it's not against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence to award those damages. And as you know, the court cannot substitute its own judgment for that of the jury, who is there to determine the credibility of the witnesses.
Are you saying you don't have to offer any evidence at all of her wages after the partnership ended?
I'm saying something slightly different, and that is that the evidence of what she made prior to the conclusion of the partnership or before the tort was committed is sufficient for the jury to make a determination about what she would have made after.
But not what she did make. So what is the evidence of the exact amount she lost, not the amount she would have earned if the partnership still existed, but the difference between what she actually did earn and what she would have earned?
Again, I think that when the court reviews the transcript and applies the legal standards that that are longstanding in the state of Texas, that the factual sufficiency standard of review would not require a reversal in this matter, just based on a reading of what the evidence that the jury had before them. And it compiled with the fact that this argument is was waived by the failure to object to the submission to the jury charge. And that's
the evidence, when you look at it, shows how much you made prior to the time of the eviction.
Correct.
And then there's no evidence about whether she even worked after that time. As I understand, what reading I've done of the record and the transcript, there's no one asked her a question about, are you working today, and how much are you making? Nobody asked that.
Nobody asked the question about whether or not she was working today, but there is some testimony in the record that reflects that she did find another job as a nail technician in a different location. That's
so she was working.
Yes, Your Honor, and that will be in Reporter Record Volume 2 and 4 again on when she was called to the stand a second time in the defense.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you have any other questions in, with respect to the lost wages issue? Okay. On lost profits, again, there was a failure to object to the charge prior to the submission, but the evidence at the trial was legally and factually sufficient to find to support the jury's finding of lost profits. The standard is that the amount of lost profits must be shown by competent evidence with reasonable certainty. And put simply, there must be a reasonable basis for the amount sought. Again, under the applicable legal standards, more than a scintilla of evidence was presented at trial to support the jury's finding, and we would ask that the court not disturb that on appeal. Finally, I think I mentioned this at the beginning of our discussion, but the civil conspiracy claim. The appellants complain about the submission of the jury charge on civil conspiracy, but they failed to object to that submission. Again, the evidence presented at trial showed that there was no principal or agency relationship between Appellant Vo and Appellant Nguyen. It was just simply about payment of rent. And so their actions of conspiring to open a new business and locking Ms. Appellant, the appellee out of the business was a separate tort action that caused, that was a civil conspiracy, and it was proper for the court to put that in the jury charge.
Was there any evidence that Mr. Nguyen was paid any money for his activity of allowing he and his wife's name to be on the lease and then also getting himself listed on the assumed name certificate? He get paid any money for that? And if I understand the record, the rent was all paid directly to the landlord and not through Mr. Nguyen to the landlord.
You're correct in all of your statements. The evidence at trial showed that Mr. Nguyen and his wife were friends with Appellant Vo for quite some time, and he did that for 2 years apparently out of the goodness of his heart, but at some point in time the tables turned and the parties conspired to kick Miss Vu out of her business and for the appellants to begin running that business together. And they continued to operate it after evicting her. So. Well, we appreciate the court's time today, and appellee respectfully request that the court would sustain the trial court's judgment in all respects. So if there's nothing further from the court, I would give the remainder of my time back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick? As I understand the argument, there was evidence that she had certain income before the end of the contract or the end of the partnership, but you didn't offer any evidence to show that she had any income afterwards. And even though there was mentioned that she did have employment, your obligation was to show some offsetting income. Otherwise, the evidence was she used to earn this, and there's no evidence that she earned anything afterwards, leaving the jury with essentially evidence of no income afterwards, even though there was evidence that she was employed. So you're saying you had no burden to show that?
Yes.
She.
They're asking for recovery for one of their elements of damages is the lost wages. They have to establish first that she was entitled to lost wages, and then secondly, they have to show what wages she lost.
Right. They show.
The opposite assumption could be just as well made that when she left that business and she went to work for another business, she made an equal or greater amount. You can make that same assumption either way. It's not our burden to disprove their element of proof. Their element of proof to prove wages is to prove this is what I made before, this is what I made after. The difference is what you owe me as damages. It's not the burden of the defendant to prove the opposite of that. It's just not our burden. It's their element of damages. It's not an affirmative defense. It's basically they're trying to prove lost wages. It's their burden to prove the lost wages. It's not our. You can't just make an assumption that because she was making this amount of money, that she didn't make anything afterwards. Where there's equal assumptions, you can't make either one. The equal assumption could be, well, she made twice as much afterwards, so there's no lost wages, as opposed to she didn't work at all. You can't, either one of those assumptions are equally valid. So you can't jump to one or the other. It's their burden to carry, and they didn't carry the burden. I would like to point out one last thing to clear up a little bit with respect to the doctrine of election of remedies. The doctrine of election of remedies is an affirmative defense, but the only purpose of the doctrine of election of remedies is to allow a defendant to force the plaintiff to pick one measure of damages or one cause of action, whatever measure he's trying to recover, has to pick before it goes to the jury. Doesn't have anything to do with the issue of recovery after the trial. For example, one of the cases they cite that says it's an affirmative defense, the paragraph after it says that election remedy is an affirmative defense, the court in Bound versus Longo said, when the prevailing party fails to elect between alternative measures of damages, the court should utilize the findings affording the prevailing party the greater recovery and render judgment accordingly. When a trial court fails to do this, the appellate court will reform the trial court's judgment to effect such election. That's out of the case they cited for the proposition that the doctrine of election of remedies is an affirmative defense. That same language is used in the AZZ case that this court rendered last year that says basically has the same statement. It says a party is entitled to but one satisfaction for the injury sustained him. Thus, when a defendant's acts result in a single injury and the jury returns favorable findings on more than one theory of liability, the plaintiff is entitled to judgment on the theory affording him the greatest relief. And that is the obligation of the trial court. And if the trial court doesn't do it, that becomes the obligation of the Court of Appeals to pick which measure of damages that should be used. And that's what we're arguing here with respect to Ms. Vo. They can either have a contract measure of damages against her or they can have the tort measure of damages against her, but they can't have both. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument today. Your case is submitted. We'll recess briefly to make panel changes. You're free to go about your business, or if you want to stay and watch the next case argued, you're welcome to do that.